Coming up this week, fear the fatal fungus.
There's a lot of fungal biodiversity out there, and we're finding out that more and more of it has this rather nasty characteristic.
And knowing how to network, quantum style.
So basically, this is a network that allows you to send multiple possible answers that you don't know before you send them.
That's correct, yes.
Plus rigid hierarchies and old boys' networks, the barriers to great science in India. This is the Nature Podcast. I'm Jeff Marsh.
And I'm Kerry Smith. Fungi have long posed a threat to human livelihoods. The Irish potato famine of the late 19th century was caused by a fungal-like infection, and the resulting starvation and economic ruin altered the course of human history. There are several other examples of fungal and fungal-like pathogens decimating plant species. In the last few decades, pathogenic fungi have begun to be recognised as posing a serious threat to animal populations too. Matthew Fisher at Imperial College London and colleagues have written a review this week highlighting the current risk to biodiversity and food security posed by fungi. They warn that as humans change natural environments and transport fungal species outside of their natural range, the threat to plant and animal diversity will only increase. Jeff spread his natural range and went to meet Matthew.
I've come to an underground laboratory packed with tadpoles and newts to come and speak with Matthew Fisher, an infectious disease biologist at Imperial College. Hello, Matthew.
Hello.
Why are we surrounded by all these amphibians?
Well, here we have a large box full of newts which are just coming back into the water after being hibernated over winter. And what's in common with all of these newts here is that they're infected by a very highly virulent lineage of the fungus, Batrachochytrium dendrobatidis, which has been spreading like wildfire around the world, causing a number of these species extinctions that we're seeing. The Majorcan midwife toads, on the other hand, have got a very similar lineage of the fungus, but it doesn't kill, at least not on the level that we see with the strain that's infecting these newts. So it seems that not only are we moving these very highly aggressive forms of fungi around, but we're also moving other less aggressive forms around. And what really kind of comes together is that we're actually just doing a lot of moving around of absolutely everything. There's just this whole global rearrangement going on, not only in fungi, but also in bacteria, viruses, vertebrates, pretty much anything you care to mention.
So would you say that all these recent outbreaks in the wild animal populations are down to human activity?
Yes, all of these disease emergences are symptomatic, essentially, of globalisation.
And so your research in this lab working on this one particular pathogen fits into a wider global picture of the impact fungal pathogens are having on wild animal species.
Yes, it does. So we now know that there are probably more than 3.5 million species of fungi out there, only a handful of which are known to cause serious disease in vertebrates. But importantly, that number is increasing year on year. So scientists in the United States are finding that this new species of fungus, Geomyces, is causing the destruction of the North American bats, and then we're seeing fungi that were previously thought to be non-virulent causing declines in coral in the Caribbean, and it goes on and on. So yes, there's a lot of fungal biodiversity out there, and we're finding out that more and more of it has this rather nasty characteristic.
So you mentioned in the review paper that you've written that biodiversity worldwide may well suffer at the hands of these fungal pathogens. But you also mentioned that, you know, disease is not thought to be a common cause of extinction usually. Why is that?
Well, evolutionary theory shows that as the host becomes rarer, as pathogens drive the density down, then the pathogen itself tends to go extinct before the host does, and then the host bounces back. And this is the normal density-dependent cycle that you see with a host and its pathogen. However, fungi have this set of characteristics that enable them to evade these limiting mechanisms. So particularly, what fungi are very good at doing is persisting in the environment or infecting many, many species, so they're generalist parasites. So that means that when you've driven your susceptible species down to very low levels, the chances are that you're also holding out in another tolerant species. So you keep on
releasing infective stages into the environment, and eventually you overwhelm that susceptible species and bang, it's gone.
Mitigating the effects of these fungal pathogens on crops surely takes precedent because of their direct association with food security. What do you see to be the required measures for protecting these wild animal populations?
Well, as you rightly point out, there's a huge industry that goes into protecting crops against fungal pathogens, but you just can't do that in natural wildlife populations. It really is an incredibly difficult problem. I mean, certainly on the island of Majorca, where we have these beautiful Majorcan midwife toad tadpoles, we've actually gone there and we've caught every animal in the valley and we've treated it with an antifungal drug and we've kept it in a biosecure facility until we hope that the fungus has disappeared from the environment, and then we've put them back. So essentially we've tried this environmental mitigation and it really just hasn't worked. So yes, we have to be very creative in the solutions that we use against these pathogens in the future. But essentially, the bottom line is just don't introduce them in the first place.
Right, so prevention should form the key, you think?
Yeah, in this case, prevention is the cure.
I mean, it's very obvious to put a value on crop species that might be being infected by fungal pathogens. How do you put a value on these wild populations of frogs and newts, etc.?
Well, this is, of course, a very difficult problem. We don't really understand the wider value of the ecosystem services that these species produce. Some scientists in America have attempted to do this, and they've costed out the services that the bats do every year by eating pests. And this turns out to be a very big number, $3.5 billion per year, perhaps more. And similarly, you know, these frogs are going to be providing services which are essential to us. However, we've never actually put a number to this, and this is really important these days, because to actually recognize the value of these species and the loss owing to these new diseases that accrue, we really need to understand the actual financial cost that they provide to us.
So I should probably say thank you to this tadpole.
You should probably say thank you to that tadpole.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Tadpole, and thank you, Matthew.
Thank you very much.
Matthew Fisher in his lab at Imperial College London.
Coming up shortly, hot off the press, the news chat with Richard Van Norden. But first, a peculiar kind of network. Imagine a computer network that is fed random information and spits that same random information out. Every time you read out a message, you won't be sure what you'll get. Even more confusing, to use this network, you aren't allowed to see the random messages you put into it. It might sound a bit pointless, but researchers see potential in just such a network, based on the principles of quantum mechanics. Stefan Ritter at the Max Planck Institute for Quantum Optics in Germany has developed a technique that could lead to quantum networking, and Jeff Bromfield called him on a regular phone network.
There are many applications for transmitting a quantum state. And one is that with a quantum computer, you'd build on these strange quantum states. And if you want distributed quantum computing, say, like one does with cloud computing all the time, then we might want to exchange quantum states. And exchanging classical states is just not enough. Another application is quantum cryptography. So quantum cryptography, also building on these superposition states and entanglement, allows you to exchange a secret key with, if you do everything correctly, absolute security. And to do so, you also need to exchange quantum states. But you can't copy a quantum state. And also, if you measure it, you alter the quantum state. So say you have a quantum state and you don't know what it is and you want to send it to me, then you don't have the opportunity of measuring it and sending it to me via a classical channel. You have to send it by some means like we do.
You can't even read the information before you send it. This is just sounding like the weirdest network ever to me.
Well, I mean, if you prepare a quantum state and you know that state, then you could, of course, just call me and tell me, well, I have this quantum state, try to prepare it at your place, and then I have the same quantum state. But sometimes, say, some person in the future would do a quantum computation, and there's a quantum state that comes out as a result. Then if you measure that, you won't get the full quantum state, because, as you said, if you have these superpositions being 0 and 1 at the same time, then the measurement process will project the state onto either 0 or 1 and thereby destroy the quantum state that you initially had. So then measuring and sending is not an alternative in the quantum world.
So basically, this is a network that allows you to send multiple possible answers that you don't know before you send them.
That's correct, yes.
And so let's talk a little about how you actually did it, because it wasn't even clear that this could be done.
That's right. So when we talk about a quantum network, what we mean is that you have network nodes, and between those, you transmit the information. So as a transmitter, single photons are ideally suited because they fly at the speed of light, and you can make them interact rather weakly with the environment, so they're great for transmitting information from A to B. But then they are not stationary, and so they are not suitable as network nodes. And so what we take as network nodes are single atoms. And now the task is to transfer quantum information from the stationary node, so from the single atom, onto a single photon, then transmit it via your quantum channel, which typically is an optical fiber, to the other network node, and there to convert it from the photon onto the other single atom that's at this second node, and then have it stored there.
You can do some really crazy things with this network. You're able to tweak one part of the network to actually manipulate a physically separated part of it instantly. Is that right?
That's right. So what we've done in the second experiment is that we've entangled the two network nodes. So what we do is we produce a single photon from one of the network nodes, and in such a way that the polarization of this photon is entangled with the atom or the internal atomic state. And then we send again the photon over and store it coherently in the second network node. And we achieve this in such a way that the two single atoms, even though they've never seen each other, they are entangled.
And it would work instantly between...
That's correct.
That's the really weird thing.
Yes.
I assume this network can't communicate faster than the speed of light.
No, it can't, because you always need a classical communication channel.
That was Stefan Ritter talking to Jeff Brumfield. Find the article at nature.com/nature.
The barriers to science in India coming up soon, but now here's Corrie Locke in Boston with the research highlights.
Take a trip through southern Italy near Naples, and you'll come across many buildings made of a yellow volcanic rock called tuff. Tuff is definitely not tough, though. It is known for being a weak building material. At least one type of tuff could pose an even greater hazard in the event of a fire. Researchers subjected three types of tuff used in Italy to high heat and then tested the rock's strength. They found that the most commonly used rock, called Neapolitan yellow tuff, lost 80% of its compressive strength as temperatures reached 1,000 degrees Celsius. That's because this tuff contains zeolite minerals that are sensitive to heat. The researchers suggest that the results be considered in establishing regional fire codes. They also recommend similar tests for tuff used in other regions. The study was published in the journal Geology. Another paper that caught our eye looks at the growth of lymphatic vessels in the body. These vessels transport white blood cells and fluids and often sprout at sites of inflammation. They've also been linked to the spread of cancerous tumors. So biologists would love to get a glimpse of these vessels growing inside living animals. Now they can. Researchers have genetically engineered a mouse that produces a luminescent protein only in tissues where a lymphatic gene is turned on. They captured images of lymphatic vessels growing in live mice during embryo development and wound healing. They could even see vessels growing at the edge of melanoma tumors. The authors suggest that lymphatic growth may help cancer spread to distant organs. You can find the paper in the journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences.
India has always treasured education, but it's having a hard time translating that into world-class science. Lack of money isn't the problem, according to chemist Gautam Desiraju at the Indian Institute of Science in Bangalore. He thinks it's a cultural thing. I gave him a call to find out what he meant.
Science is based on a systematic questioning and a logical approach. It's the questioning I'm saying we are not able to do, because our cultural value system does not allow us to do this so easily. India is a country where conformity is given a very high priority. Listening to people who you feel are older than you or more powerful than you is very, very important, and not sticking out not sticking out like a sore thumb.
And the barriers are not financial necessarily, but there are these psychological barriers.
I think so, and I think the psychological barriers are very, very serious. I call it the feudal colonial mentality. So the first consequence is that we are not able to question. And the second thing is we worship older people. A postdoctoral person, it starts at a very basic level. A postdoctoral person comes back to India from a very good lab abroad and continues to do the same thing. Now, if he did that in the UK or the USA or Germany, he would not rise in his job because innovation is given the maximum points. This is I'm addressing a basic sociological issue. And therefore, I think what policymakers need to do is they have to factor this in into their calculations. Because otherwise say that you're not in this game of doing international science. But once you say that I want to compete with the others, I want to get my paper into so-and-so journal and so on and so on, then you have to do it in a way that is compatible with the whole system. Not what we are doing. This is some kind of a mishmash. And I really fear this extra money into the system now, because I know it's just going to be like, you know, pouring money down a rat hole.
What do you think that policymakers can practically do about this?
I've given a number of suggestions. Now, the short term, start providing small funding to a very large number of people. Doesn't matter if many of these projects fail, but there should be a feeling of mass participation. And then when you do provide big money, these should be of, you know, in critical areas, I've mentioned energy, water, and public health. So the funding can be very high, the accountability should be high, and there should be proper exit options. In other words, if the thing is not working, we should have the guts to close it down. And third, which I believe is actually the most important, the single factor that has eaten like a cancer into our system is our system of awards, prizes, and recognitions in higher level science in India today. And that is taken as the only reckoning of success. So I think these three things are easy to do. Then there are long-term things. I think it's a question of having the courage and the honesty to admit that things are not okay. Try to look for the basic causes. If you do the thing correctly, it doesn't matter how long it takes. But if you start the thing wrong, then you will never get there.
That was Gautam Desiraju at the Indian Institute of Science.
Finally this week, time for a news update. Richard, what have you got?
Well, it seems like the dust is settling on this enormous controversy about whether researchers are allowed to publish papers in which they mutated the avian flu virus to be transmissible between mammals, between ferrets. Now, you remember that last year, a US advisory board said that this stuff shouldn't be published and the papers should be censored. And there was a lot of debate about that. Eventually, last week, this National Science Advisory Board for Biosecurity revised what it had thought earlier and said, yeah, the studies can be published. And at a meeting at the Royal Society in London last week, scientists actually described what they'd done, which until now wasn't entirely clear.
OK, so the publishing of the uncensored papers has got the green light. What's the concern now?
The problem is that at the moment, it looks like national export controls might prevent some of the information being published, even though this board says that these papers can be published. So export control laws are what governments put in place to limit the shipment of technologies that could be used for weapons. And at the moment, the Dutch government has slapped export controls on the information in the paper. And this is why at the meeting in London, while Yoshihiro Kawaoka at the University of Wisconsin-Madison could talk about his paper on which the US government had lifted export controls, Ron Fouchier of Rotterdam in the Netherlands, he said he couldn't talk about his paper because export controls were still in place from the Dutch government. Now, if that issue gets resolved, as it might well be by the end of April, other people at the meeting said, well, the real problem is that there might be some sort of worldwide proliferation of research on flu mutation in labs that are not as safe as the ones in the Netherlands and the United States where this work was done.
And are there people gearing up to do this research?
Well, right now, there's a moratorium on any research to make flu viruses more transmissible. The World Health Organization ordered this. And one can assume that there's going to be more interest in this kind of work. They may point out ways in which, if the flu virus picks up mutations, it can become more transmissible. Now, US and Dutch authorities are trying to assess the safety conditions for such research, and within weeks they're going to release their verdicts. But then lifting the moratorium might be seen as arrogant, people at the meeting worried, because US lawmakers still want to have hearings on this. There's a bit of a feeling that these researchers are keeping these questions within their close-knit community and not letting bioethicists and the wider public have a real debate on this matter.
Okay, and bearing bioethics in mind, your next story is about some unapproved stem cell therapies in China.
There's a Nature investigation this week on the many businesses in China who are offering stem cell treatments for conditions like autism, Parkinson's, and multiple sclerosis, costing anywhere between $30,000 and $200,000 for injections. Now, for years, these businesses have been offering these kinds of treatments. It's all readily available on their websites, and it all looks very approved and safe, although they kind of readily admit that there's not much data out there. Actually, this isn't the case. None of these stem cell treatments are approved. And in January, the Chinese Health Ministry, recognizing this difficult situation, try to enforce a package of rules on the industry banning unapproved stem cell trials and telling local health authorities to halt any unapproved use of stem cells in their regions.
And so give us a sense of how widespread this is.
An estimate in 2009 was that there were 100 businesses in China offering these kinds of treatments. People are coming to China to get these treatments, and they all claim to have success in treating patients. But none of them has actually published any data from controlled clinical trials. We're arguing that's not good enough. You can't just offer treatments on the basis that they seem to be safe and that they may be effective.
Are they proving to be dangerous, these treatments?
We talk to stem cell experts who say the therapies aren't ready for clinics, and that even though the clinics say they're safe, they might endanger patients' health. So Oliver Cooper, who's at the stem cell facility of the Neuroregeneration Institute at McLean Hospital in Massachusetts. He's a specialist in Parkinson's, and talking about Tong Yuan's treatment for Parkinson's, he said, you know, these products could provide anecdotal, poorly controlled, transient improvements in the patients, but Parkinson's disease patients need long-term therapies. It's no good treating someone and saying, oh, after a few weeks, they seem to be getting better and we sent them away. They went back to another country. You need long-term follow-up, which it's not obvious that these clinics are doing.
And so is there a predicted timeline for stamping this practice out?
There is no timeline. So a Ministry of Health representative told us that they were aware of the problem and they'd be making greater efforts to clean up the stem cell business.
Okay, and finally, a fun story about a new solar system.
There's a solar system outside our own which has more planets than us. We've been beaten. This is according to a reanalysis of data taken by the High Accuracy Radial Velocity Planet Searcher, which has this great acronym HARPS. It's a telescope in Chile. It looked at this star system, HD 10180, and it's got 9 planets, according to Mikko Tuomi, who's at the Centre for Astrophysics Research at Hertfordshire in the UK. Now, when this data first came out in 2010, the HARPS team said that the solar system only had 5 planets and maybe 6 or 7. But they were kind of looking at this for, can the data support evidence for a 7th planet, for an 8th planet? And this guy's taken a slightly different statistical approach, saying, if we look at all possible scenarios, which is most consistent with the data in total? And he says there's a 99.7% probability that there are 9 planets in the solar system. Remember that the only way you can see these planets is to look for wobbles in the star that they're orbiting. You cannot see these planets directly because they're too far away.
So this new solar system has 9 planets, of course, ours has 8. I hadn't realised that that was a big number for a solar system.
Well, basically it comes down to, can we detect the planets out there? Because they're very small. When they get to the size of Earth or smaller, they don't have much effect on their star's wobble. So we're spotting these solar systems. We've seen maybe 200, 300 solar systems. 700 planets confirmed. There's maybe another 2,000 candidates. So I should expect to find that our solar system's importance rapidly dwindles to something like mid-sized largeness. So right now, it's up there at number 2, but we might see it fall away in future years.
And of course, the inevitable question, did any of the planets look sort of habitable?
Nope, none of them look habitable. It's proving quite difficult to find a planet that is like Earth and has the right conditions. So these eighth and ninth planets in this system are five and twice the mass of Earth, respectively, and of course very far away from their stars, so much too cold to support life. But we're still searching. So that is the dream for all of this kind of research, is to find that Earth twin out there.
OK, thanks, Richard. And remember, all Nature News content is freely available at nature.com/news.
That's all we've got time for. Next week, space weather and what lit the fuse for the Cambrian explosion. I'm Kerry Smith.
And I'm Jeff Marsh.